The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind of sentinel.
Mr. DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host, John DePietro.
All right, here we go, folks. Welcome to the lunchtime. Good afternoon, one and all. Here I am. It's Juan. It's John DePietro. We start weekdays at 11. We go till 2. It's AM 1380, 99.9 FM. You can always listen online at either DePietro.com, WNRI.com. This portion of the program is brought to you by J.K.L. Engineering. Hey, the heating season is here. Let J.K.L. Engineering design and install a natural gas, high-efficiency carrier infinity system. They're energy efficient, they're quiet, more affordable than you think. If you're saying no gas, well, then no problem. Let J.K.L. Engineering design and install a high-efficiency heat pump system, including ductless splits. It can reduce your oil bill by as much as 90%. They have the highest rebates in the market. And they also do new installation and replacement of high-efficiency gas boilers licensed in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Call J.K.L. Engineering today at 401-351-7600, 401-351-7600 for J.K.L. Engineering. I want to say good afternoon to everybody on Facebook Live. Next hour, radio icon Don Imus. Imus did die on Friday, and we're going to talk about him. I'm going to remember him next hour, including three different times. I was on with Imus over 15 times. I think actually closer to 20 at one point when I was adding it up. But I'm going to play some of those coming up next hour, 10 plus more of your phone calls. But folks, it is a Monday, and let's go to him. He's the managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. And say good afternoon to our friend Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Great to be with you.
Justin, I want to start off with the Dan McGowan story last week in the Boston Globe. Get your thought on it. And it is the fact that, and it's just ironic to me, and we'll touch on a little bit. I mean, last week when we spoke, we talked about how Governor Raimondo, who was just reelected last November, you know, has served another 4-year term. She's already basically saying, and it, to me, you know, her number one priority is to get involved with the 2020 presidential race. It's, you know, it's almost like she's bored being the governor. And here you have Mayor Alorza, who was also reelected, and tells Dan McGowan of the Boston Globe that he is certainly seriously looking at a run for governor in 2022. And I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, to some extent, it's not surprising. I mean, he's term limited himself, and there are only so many places you can go. He's blocked off probably from Congress, thanks to David Cicilline. So it isn't surprising that he would be thinking about it. What's surprising is that, I mean, Rhode Island politics at this point has a kind of a strange feel. Alorza, and we said this, I think, when he first was looking into becoming mayor, or I did anyway, it's not clear what his qualifications are, why his background prepares him for this, what his successes have been that justify a leap to the higher office. So it's almost as if we've got a whole lot of politicians in Rhode Island who are just saying, well, you know, this is the next step on the path. I don't know where to go next, so this is where I'll go. And that's kind of the feel I get from it. I mean, he's still got a number of years to prove the rationale, but it just, there's something missing. And I was thinking about it, and I feel like what it is a lot of our politicians, they don't want to address the actual problems, because that would mean going up against the unions especially, and increasingly the progressives. And because they won't go up against them, they're not really doing anything that would make you say, this person is material for governor. Therefore, they're all just kind of waiting in line. It's anybody's game, Secretary of State, Mayor, Treasurer, whoever, whatever. We just need somebody to fill that seat. That's kind of the feel I got from it.
You know what? That's an excellent point, Justin. If you are looking at and openly talk about, you know, jumping for the next office, regardless of whether or not you're term limited out, which he is, then you're not really focused on doing the job that's ahead of you now. To me, it then becomes more about, so many of your decisions are impacted on how that might affect should you decide to run for governor. And by all accounts, like, I find it astounding. I think
and we've kind of talked about it, and I have my sister on once a week, Donna Perry. Basically, he's like, you know, he's not a mayor. He's like a community activist. That's what he really thinks his role is. If you look at the type of job he's done, that 195 land is so vacant that they even felt the need to pull it away from him with all the problems he's put Jason Fain through. Anyone that listened, the Paw Sox, they had some dealings with him, and it became very apparent they had no interest in then doing anything in Providence because some of the hurdles that have come in. The schools have been taken away from him. Providence, the east side, the homes that are selling on the east side, the property values are way down from where they used to be. I mean, way down. And, it's amazing how you don't step back and say, my God, like, what have you done that would ever warrant you to think you're ready for the next level? Because, I don't think he's done a good job as mayor in any way, aside from the element. I mean, if the only barometer people are going to use is whether or not, you know, that someone is led away in handcuffs, right? As like, that's the barometer of whether or not they did a good job. The whole thing of like, well, at least he's honest. He's not a crook. I mean, boy, that is such a low bar to set if that always becomes, you know, the measuring stick.
Donna's characterization of him as kind of a community activist is right on, I think. You get a sense from him and from other politicians in the state at this time. They're just kind of filling in seats. And so because there's really not much they're going to do. They're not going to try to challenge the system, the way it works. They're not going to come up with anything big or really stand up to the labor unions the way they deserve or try to push back on the progressives and improve the economic climate or whatever it might be, or increase security around Providence. They're not going to do any of that, and everybody knows it. And at this point, I think there's a feeling that people who would do that aren't going to be elected. And so what you get, this sense of people just, okay, I'm here now, filling in the seat. I'll bring a slightly different flavor than some other candidate might have. But for the most part, we're all just going to go along with the way things have been, try to make some improvements around the margins, and that's just supposed to be good enough. And we're not seeing a lot of, I think it ties also with, we're not seeing a lot of new, fresh faces of people who have some kind of really significant out-of-government experience. So, and I don't mean like an out-of-body experience, but I mean, you know, we don't see people coming in from the military saying, okay, I'm gonna give a go for governor, or like Brendan Doherty, that would have been a policeman, state police, or business people coming out of their where they've been successful and coming in and saying, let's see if I can apply those lessons to government. We're not seeing that. We're seeing kind of, you know, float around career politicians going along and getting along and just putting in their time, going for the next seat. There you go. That's really what we're seeing. And I think it goes back to this idea that they're not going to change anything in any office they take. And everybody knows that. So it sort of just runs on autopilot.
You know, I think you're right. And again, folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. And Justin, I think that fight at the mall over the course of the weekend, this is a busy time. They're lucky it didn't happen the weekend before Christmas. But to me, you have a mayor, Mayor Alorza. He's the one that the years ago under Angel Tavares, you couldn't loiter downtown, and therefore the police would keep people moving. And Alorza comes in and suddenly says, "Well, you can loiter. We're not going to do that." So, what do you have around Kennedy Plaza, around that area? You have people laying on sidewalks, lying on benches. We talk about voters that move with their feet. Businesses move with their feet. Nordstrom, they closed up and left the mall. CVS is closing, the only store they have, the only drugstore that's downtown. So you want to encourage people to live downtown, but then you're not willing to provide the proper provisions and security. I was speaking with someone the other day that said, you know, you have people that when they are having meetings with people that come in from out of town. So the office is downtown. The people are staying at the Westin, and they actually send a car and have them take a car, as opposed to, I mean, it would be, what, a five-minute walk to walk through Kennedy Plaza. But you're talking about, you know, people asking you for money. And what people don't realize, it's in a very aggressive fashion. And there's drug addicts, and there's people lying on the sidewalk and lying on benches. And they did have the big raid at Kennedy Plaza. So now CVS closes. And I go back to look at this, you know, very wild video fight from Saturday night. And from what I understand, there were fights inside and outside. There's far more that goes on in that mall that even gets reported. They have, Providence Police has a gang unit that's there on Friday nights because the gang problem is so bad. A lot of stuff gets covered up. But you hear nothing from the mayor. And I go back to Justin Katz. You had that shooting at Providence Place Mall right outside of Nordstrom's, on Martin Luther King Day. And Mayor Loza described it as just some knucklehead when it turned out to be someone from Pawtucket who had an illegal firearm. And Nordstrom's immediately, you know, left a few months after that. I think they don't make the correlation that it's his governing style that it leads to more violence and more crime.
Certainly. And the thing of it is, he's not even all that original in this regard. I mean, what struck me about the whole thing was my family went to the Disney on Ice at the Dunkin' Donuts Center that night, and one of my teenagers said, hey, let's go to the mall. And, you know, I was kind of reluctant to do that for other reasons. I mean, Christmas is kind of expensive. But to see a story that there was a couple fights, almost brawl, a few hours later, it really adds to that impression of this is not a place you want to go. And the detail that jumped out at me from some of the reporting was speculation or hints that the teenagers were using social media to plan to meet up for a fight.
Yes.
At the mall.
Yep.
You know, now, planning to meet up for a fight is nothing new for teenagers. But, you know, when I was younger, you would try to find somewhere where you wouldn't get caught, you know, where you would out of the way. So the idea, it seems to be a few things are changing. And one of them is that I think social media is creating the idea of wanting to make a spectacle of things. But two is this sort of brazen, it goes to what you're saying, this brazen lack of fear of getting caught, because they know that the authorities do not want to prosecute this. That really contributes to it. And I think third, there's also a give and take. Nordstrom's might leave because the environment is getting too rough. But also, when a store like Nordstrom leaves, a higher-end store, that changes the feel. It changes the kind of people who are there. It changes what feels acceptable in that location. And I think those are things that contribute to this. And I think it goes on a policy front. I think you also have to look at the Obama administration's tightening the screws on schools to reduce racial disparities in discipline. Which even showed its face in the Johns Hopkins report in Providence, where kids don't feel like there are consequences for anything they do. I think that's part of the problem. And I also have to think back to when a year or two ago, when a big issue in Providence was this Community Safety Act or something like that, where they actually put handcuffs on police on how they could track gangs in the city. And I think this kind of idea creates this sense that, you know, there aren't consequences. We're going to look the other way. We're not going to crack down on fights. We're not going to discipline kids in school. We're going to prevent the police from being able to track gang activity as well as they ought to be able to. That creates this impression where, and again, this wasn't just Providence. Some of the kids from the reporting were from Pawtucket, some from Cranston. So it creates this environment where they're scheduling fights like teenagers have always done, at least teenage boys, and they're picking a mall in the capital city, which is incredible. I mean, that's this environment is really getting to where, as you say, you don't want to go into the city. You'll go there if you have to. You go to your car, you get out of there, or you go directly where you need to go. But you don't say, hey, while I'm here, let's go walk around the mall at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, because who knows what kind of fights are going to break out.
Right. And let's, you know, you and I know that a senior advisor to Mayor Loza for part of this year was Aaron Ruggenberg. And they have a different approach. You know, I was looking at an article that someone sent me, and there's a growing movement in America to abolish the police. And that is part of the progressive mindset. They always downplay crime. And anytime if someone says that they're fearful of crime, you know, when I was seeing it with some of the stories and people's reaction to some of this stuff, they immediately try to portray that if you're afraid of crime, oh, that means you're a racist. You just don't want to be around, you know, people of color and everything. And that's not what it's about. The last time I went to Providence Place Mall, like a lot of people, the reason I went there was because of the Apple Store. I did used to go to Nordstrom, but now they've pulled out of there. But the Apple Store is the big draw. But what really stuck out to me was I found it sad because the number of empty storefronts that are there. I mean, when Providence Place Mall first opened, in those first, I'll even say 5 to 10 years, I mean, the mall was thriving, especially in the first, you know, it opened in 99. And up until, you know, the recession 2008, past couple of years, I don't go there as much. And when I did, that's what really stuck out at me. And I always find that sad when you go somewhere and then you see, my God, like, look at all these empty storefronts. It's like a ghost town. And then you just kind of give over to that. But I come back to what people like Mayor Alorza and Aaron Ruggenberg, and you're even seeing in New York. I mean, it took 8 attacks before this de Blasio announces that maybe they need to beef up patrols in some of the Jewish neighborhoods. It's this casual attitude towards crime, and they always downplay the crime the way Alorza did. You know, you had a fight at the mall a couple months ago, and they're like, oh, it was just some kids, or somebody with a handgun's just a knucklehead. On this, he doesn't even comment. They always downplay it as if it, oh, you know that's just like teenage. But my thing is it's bad for business if it hurts economic activity. People don't feel safe going up to Federal Hill as much anymore because there's crime. If someone gets robbed somewhere, it's very traumatic, and they don't want to just go back there. And there's other options. There's other places to go. Instead, if you had a safe environment, if you had police there, if the kids knew the police were going to be there and they're aggressive, and then you don't schedule fights in public like that. So my point is, I think his political style, which, as you know, it's ultra left, it's very progressive. To me, it borders on like anti-law enforcement. It hurts a city far more than it helps.
Certainly, and I'm glad you brought up New York. I mean, I grew up right outside New York, and I, you know, from that period where, you know, Woody Allen would have a movie making jokes about how you just casually have to pay your mugger as you walk down the street. You know, I'm your mugger today. That from that to really a revolutionary change where it was felt really safe. And a lot of that had to do with the policing and the idea, the broken windows idea, where if you keep things looking good and have people know they won't get away with stuff, it affects the city. And now we're seeing that decreasing in New York. But one thing that strikes me as very relevant, it was just a few years ago, the police, the chief, I think it was, who was largely involved in that whole idea of the stop and frisk and just creating the atmosphere we're not going to put up with nonsense in New York. When he came, I think it was Brown, he was shut down because of this attitude.
Ray Kelly, that's exactly right.
You can't do that. And that's the atmosphere. And that ties directly to Regenberg, as you say. That's the atmosphere. We're not going to let you police. Because when you police, it has disparate racial statistics. And so that's bad. And we're not going to let that go on. And it does. It creates this downward spiral where the hoodlums, and they're always hoodlums, especially among teenagers, where they feel like they can get away with stuff, that affects your likelihood to go to the mall. I mean, a lot's happened in 20 years, so the internet would have reduced the amount of traffic in the mall anyway. But when you add to that the disincentive to go in because of safety concerns, that, and then the stores start to close, and it's a kind of a depressing experience rather than an exciting one. That starts to create this spiral, and the only way government has a role in stopping it is to create that sense of to increase the sense of security, the idea that you could go there and be safe, and then it's up to the private sector to come up with the stores and all that. But I think that's where we're really falling down. It has a lot to do with this progressive attitude that the mayor certainly buys into.
It does, and I'm glad you, because some people don't understand, it's a form of government. I mean, Mayor Mike Bloomberg, I'll give him that, when he was the mayor of New York, they identified and they adapted to stop and frisk. And you know something, and he took heat for that, and now, unfortunately, he's apologizing for it on the presidential front, and the number of people, oh, he's going to have to, you know, have answer for stop and frisk. And the fact that that is ignored, and Ray Kelly, he was shouted down when he was invited to speak at Brown University. They wouldn't even let him speak. And he was invited to speak there about the policy of stop and frisk. What is ignored, Justin, is stop and frisk cut down on crime. And the people that I know from law enforcement that say what the progressives and the Aaron Ruggenbergs and the Alorses and the de Blasios, the people that they completely ignore are there are many people in poor neighborhoods. They're not bad people. They're not criminals. They're just poor. And they welcome the police, and they're thankful to the police. And, you know, years ago, I mean, I haven't done it in a while, but I've done ride-arounds sometimes with law enforcement, and you go to some tough areas and tough streets, and some of the people there, that they're good people, they just happen to be poor people, they are so grateful to law enforcement. Thank you for arresting that drug dealer. Thank you for arresting those gang members that break windows and rob people on our street and they break into houses. And what I find ironic is the Alorses, the de Blasios, and the Aaron Ruggenbergs, they pretend that the people that live in the poor neighborhoods that are grateful for the police, they ignore them. And they pretend they don't exist because all they want to highlight is how dare you and why did you stop them and you stopped them because of the color of their skin. And they don't have to live in those neighborhoods. The most critical are the people that are not affected by any of these policies.
Certainly. And it's not only the safety of their neighborhoods where they live, it's the availability of work. If there are no stores in Providence Place Mall, that's a lot of working class, lower working class jobs where they you can take a night job working there and make some money in the mall, or as a younger adult get started with a job and build your way up in a company. When those jobs go away, it's not only your home where you're affected, it's the economic opportunity that you're lacking because our economy is starting to take its signals that our government is not dedicated to making sure that we can transact our lives without these kind of disruptions, which we're just supposed to kind of tolerate.
That's exactly right. And the other last thing about this is they try to act like it's no big deal. But notice, look at, as a result of his policies, there are people, I know of people that have tried to live downtown, and they say they get tired of the aggressive panhandlers. And then the people that, some people just say, oh, you know, you can't ignore people, and that's the human condition, and that's what city life is like, and blah, blah, blah. But the fact that CVS is closing, CVS, that's the only pharmacy in downtown Providence. That's the only pharmacy, and they're closing because they've had it with the loitering in front and the people urinating on the building and the shoplifting and the drug addicts want to come in and use the bathroom and harass people. And those are all things as a result of Mayor Alorza. Because under Tavares, you didn't have loitering. They used to say to people, you can't lay on the sidewalk. You can't lay on a park bench. You can't just lay out in front of the store. But Alorza's like, oh, you know, you don't want to hassle anyone and blah, 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 and the progressive attitude. So what are you going to have? So the people that live downtown will no longer have a pharmacy to go to. And like I said, as much as we talk about it, and it's true, people vote with their feet. This is another example. Businesses do the same thing. But I don't think, do you think there's enough focus on the damage done by these, you know, casual attitudes he has? I know that one thing, Justin, that no one talks about is if you look at Providence is one of the few cities that actually has more firefighters than police. Every other city has more police than fire, as you can imagine. Why? Because you know, there's actually less fires. You certainly have a number of people that, you know, call ambulances, but that's not really a fire. But Providence actually has more firefighters than police. And as a result of that, it keeps the union strong, and they sit around the firehouse and on social media all day and blah, blah, blah. But if anything, if you reduced the number of firefighters you had and instead beefed up your police, I think you'd have a safer and more successful city.
Well, I I think that you start with the focus. And as you say, if the focus is keeping people feeling that there's order in this town and a city, that they're not going to have to, you know, step around people on a, or move around people on a bench or avoid panhandlers. If people feel like that and that's your priority, then that would necessarily increase the number of police that you have in your force. And I think that's the pitch that the progressives have, is that you go into the city, you don't have to drive around, you can walk everywhere, it's convenient. But that's not the case if you start to lose basic stores like a pharmacy. So now what, you're going to live in downtown Providence, so you'll have to store a car somewhere so you can get to a CVS relatively urgent when you have a medical issue. But you're going to be paying all this premium for living in a city with a car without the amenities of being able to walk to businesses. And it comes down to having that sense of order, and that would naturally increase your police force, and that money would have to come from somewhere. And would
That's
have to
right.
use some other budget line item. But again, it goes right back to what we were talking about with Alorza. Everybody knows there's going to be no dramatic changes. Nobody's going to say, well, we need more police, therefore we have to find reductions in our budget elsewhere. This isn't going to happen. It's just, it seems, from their perspective, almost impossible to accomplish something like that. And so they're not even going to try. And you get this slow decline, which is what we're seeing. And I think Providence Place Mall is a pretty good emblem of it at this time.
I really think it is. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. It is the John DePietro Show. We'll speak with Justin Katz, Managing Editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, I want to give you another chance, your thoughts on Governor Mundo and her year-end interviews. I don't hear a lot there as far as like game-changing type of program. Her quotes that stood out to me, end-of-year interviews, were, we need more money. There's never enough money, more in free tuition, and she wants to get more involved with 2020, and she wants to use her political war chest to go after people that are not going to be on board with what she wants to do.
That one, I think, is the most insidious of them all. And you add in the idea of the Transportation Climate Initiative, that a new gas tax she's trying to push through, just typical green progressive scheming regionally in the Northeast. It goes back to the idea that her eyes are national, and she wants to be part of that national political world, and so she'll use her position in the governor's office to do that. And I think that's a big part of why she's still collecting money, even though she's saying she's not going to run for office, but rather that she wants to use it to affect the policies that get through. That way she can turn to national friends, her national, the people she wants to be her peers nationally, and say, look, as governor, I made this happen because I replaced X number of legislators who were standing in my way. And it points to a national focus that's not going to be good for Rhode Island. I think the TCI gas tax is a pretty good representation of that. It's actually going to be painful for Rhode Islanders, especially as they have to drive out of Providence to go to CVS. But the benefit is entirely to her stature among a certain type of a progressive Democrat nationally.
What do you make of the fact that certain, I don't remember exactly, it could have been Golo or the Journal, but different people were naming her like the most dominant person. They were doing, you know, the decade, the end of the decade, 2010, we're about to enter 2020. So during that time, Governor Gina Raimondo has been the most dominant politician. And if you do that, and you could make an argument that she was elected general treasurer and then now two terms of governor. But boy, Justin Katz, if that is the case, as far as the most, had most effect, most impactful individual, I don't see how they make even an argument that I just don't see where she has improved things, not on things that need to be improved. As much as she talks about her and Stephen Pryor and commerce and all these things they're doing, and all right, so they took a lot of money and they've been doing a lot of road work, and that's stuff that should have been done for a long time. But to me, there's nothing, I don't know, there's nothing that dramatic about that. We improved the roads. I mean, that's stuff that should have been done anyway. But I haven't seen anything. If you look at her resume, the way she was touted, this game-changing individual that could sit down with CEOs, I mean, to me, what we've seen is someone that perfected raising money, seems very confident with her knowledge and ability for ground game, getting votes on election day. A lot of effort there. Certainly did a lot and has done a lot to promote herself. But I just don't see the big changes that she's made that's left, you know, a big difference here on the state. For instance, I over Christmas, you know, I was speaking with some people, and right now, if anyone takes a ride to Worcester, they are going all in on the development of this new ballpark, and they're going to have the team. Say what people, you know, they can complain about it, but they are really changing that ball club, the Woo Sox. Paw Sox now going to be Woo Sox. That is fundamentally changing Worcester. And businesses are excited, and people want to be located with the new development. But what would you say has been Raimondo's biggest accomplishment? What would you say?
I think you can only say self-promotion. I mean, in some regards, the entire apparatus of state government has been changed to focus on promoting her nationally. We've discussed this over the years, where the national press has one vision of Gina Raimondo, and you look at local stories, and it's a different one. You look at her low approval ratings in polls, and yet she won, you know, by a convincing majority in the election. It's self-promotion and working political levers, which was not what people were expecting, especially with pension reform, which, you know, nationally, I interact with people in conservative and libertarian think tanks nationally frequently, and they still have this impression of her as the one who brought pension reform. And they'll now acknowledge, well, you know, it was pretty pitiful, but at least it was something. But it kind of shows the low bar. But that was what she had worked so hard to, before becoming governor, to create this image of the no-nonsense change agent. And that, when she actually got into the governor's office, was not willing to do that sort of work, politically challenging, difficult attacks on the things that actually have to change in the state. And I think that's probably a big part of why she's now saying, yeah, I'm not interested in national politics, in national office. She wants to go into more the behind-the-scenes political. I'm sure she'd take the vice presidency if somebody offered it to her, but I think if she had come in and found it possible, given the landscape and her own abilities, found it possible to do something like a pension reform as governor, not just find more money to pour into roads, but really change the way something in government work, whether schools or infrastructure. If she had accomplished that, I think right now we would be talking, people would be talking about her for president perhaps, but certainly vice president, or maybe she'd be talking about challenging one of our congressional delegation. But we don't see that because she hasn't pulled it together, because she hasn't been the change agent, and because it's scary and risky. And I think at the end of the day, you know, she's an investment. She's kind of risk averse politically in that regard. So she worked on making sure that she's got the money and the ground game for politics to be elected, but without taking the risk of actually making the case for herself.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I agree with you that it's interesting, because this was someone to me, you know, coming after Chafee, who basically was like asleep at the switch, and nothing he wanted to do resonated. And, you know, and then the last year, after he decided he wasn't going to run, he was basically checked out. He stopped having staff meetings, and nothing was really done. CVS expanded in Boston. He didn't even know about it. He was just so intent on going after Kurt Schilling and 38 Studios and just being angry and the Christmas tree. But to me, Raimondo, when you look at, you know, she had won general treasurer, and then there she was. She won the governor's office. It's January. It's 2015. And that was an opportunity to say, we're going to put in something very bold that's going to change the dynamic. Something that it's going to take a couple years, but it's going to fundamentally change the state. And whatever that may be, we're going to lower our tax structure to be much, you know, less than Massachusetts and Connecticut, and we're going to implement this and that. And they came out talking a big game, you know, that they pitched GE, but it always became the same of they would lose, and the most important thing they would request is whoever, you know, like for the case of GE, whenever they would lose, the most important thing to them was for the person to say that even though they didn't choose the state, they were very impressed with Governor Raimondo. You know, nothing about the state. It's always about her. And before, you know, when she was general treasurer, and she was going to run for governor, someone had said to me, you know, what you need to know about her is it's about her. It's always going to be about her. And that's really all she cares about. And that was back 2011, 2012, and that person was right on the money. I mean, because that's, to me, what it has always been about. It's her raising money, her getting the headlines. The press is the win. If there's an article about you in the Washington Post, New York Times, and it's positive, then that outweighs any type of mishaps at the State House. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. We speak with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. And Justin, I wanted to give you a chance because on OceanStateCurrent.com, there is a very good piece by someone that I happen to know. And he has talked a little bit about this piece that he wrote about opioids.
Right, it's Dr. Stephen Scully. He's an oral surgeon, and he's also the chair of the board of the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity. He's focusing on, in typical Rhode Island fashion, the General Assembly decided they had to do something about the opioid crisis. And what they did was they essentially added new costs and restrictions on opioid manufacturers and distributors, wholesalers. And it's had all kinds of predictable but unintended consequences. And so he really describes how it's getting harder to get these drugs for legitimate purposes. You can't get painkillers when you need them as a medicine, because the way Rhode Island government goes about doing things is to restrict people doing legal behavior to kind of prevent overdoses on things that have nothing to do with them. And, you know, this isn't in the piece, but it ties directly to what we're talking about here with Rhode Island politicians not wanting to go after the actual issues. If you go after the fentanyl and the illegal heroin, then you're going to have uncomfortable statistics in the people you're arresting. And so it's a lot easier to tighten the screws on the companies that are putting out legal products. And so he's advocating for Dr. Scully's advocating for revisiting that approach and letting people who need painkillers. I mean, it was always a ludicrous policy to essentially tax people who need medicine because somebody else somewhere might get addicted in an overdose. And I think that's really the key of Rhode Island's problem in government, is this idea that the legislators and the governor, they're the adults in the room. They're going to come in and tell us how we're going to live, and that's going to solve problems like the opioid crisis. And it's really not the right way to go. And I think Dr. Scully points a finger at an important issue there.
Justin, folks, he is Justin Katz, managing editor of OceanStateCurrent.com. He joins us every Monday for Political Monday. Justin, great job. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you in 2020.
Yep, Happy New Year. I'm looking forward to a whole new year of seeing what happens in Rhode Island, because I'm glad to say goodbye to 2019.
That is exactly right. Thank you, folks. Justin Katz right here on the John DePietro Show.